Well, we are starting to see some daylight on our series in 1 Corinthians that we've been calling Culture versus Christianity, Part 12. And we are now in the final, Corinthians has 16 chapters. We're going to take today and next week and really look at the last chapter 15 of where Paul is really going over the various topics and problems that they've contacted him to address, and he's been writing back and going just topic by topic right down the list of the issues that they're going on. And as he finishes up this letter, it's in perfect timing for Easter for us. And I kind of joked several weeks ago when I realized that we're going to land about the same time and wrap up Corinthians as we approach Easter. And as today, as we get into chapter 15, I want to connect kind of the bookends of the Corinthian letter and draw back to the beginning. Not only chapter 15, but Paul brings up an issue that he starts off with, and the importance of the gospel message that's centered around the cross of Christ. And today, as we celebrate Palm Sunday, I want to really start there and let God lead us into an experience with the cross that I hope is something that will not only stay with you throughout the days of this Holy Week, but I hope it really stays in your heart every day of every week. But Palm Sunday is all about the big finale, the home stretch in Jesus' ministry. He spent 3 years on the road, town to town, all over Judea, parts of Galilee, throughout the urban areas, the countryside, and now he is headed toward downtown, the big city, Jerusalem. And he's kind of stayed on the outskirts for quite a while. And going against good advice that everybody's saying, look, Jesus, your poster's up in every post office in Jerusalem. You're wanted dead or alive. He's gotten way too much, you could call it good press or bad press, but he's right off the heels of bringing Lazarus back from the dead. And so that happened just about 10 short miles outside of Jerusalem in a little town called Bethany. And now everybody's talking about this guy. This could be the Messiah. He's brought somebody back to life. I mean, this isn't just any old little miracle or healing. Everybody knew that Lazarus was dead and cold in that tomb for 4 days. And now he's out and about making photo ops and all kinds of interviews, and he's basically on tour. Everybody knows what's happened. And so they're out to get you now, Jesus, because you're competition with the religious authorities. And this is what really irked everybody. This is what really got the attention of the Pharisees, the religious authorities, the Sanhedrin court, that said, okay, we've got to do something to shut this down because he's gotten way too popular. Everybody wants to make him the king, and we're losing our power and our authority to this itinerant preacher, to this to this guy without even what were his credentials? Who is this guy? And so Jesus, his target, his eye is on the target of Passover in downtown Jerusalem, and he's not going to be late for his date with destiny. And so that is what's going on. And so Palm Sunday is the week before he's arrested, and everything happens. And so he has gotten a ton of attention, and a great crowd has gathered and come for the festival. That's the Passover festival. Who heard that Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem, and they meet him at the edge of town. And the reason we call it Palm Sundays is because in order to really welcome this king and begin his coronation, they all plucked palm branches out of the trees and laid down a metaphorical red carpet, green carpet. They lay down their cloaks and these palm branches to create this path into town that they, you know, celebrate and welcome the arrival of their king, shouting, "Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the King of Israel." Hosanna simply means save us. Because for centuries, the Jewish people had been under Roman rule. And they were feeling very oppressed and waiting for a very long time for God to send his Messiah. And the expectation of this king who would come. And now everybody's very convinced that this Jesus could be this awaited Messiah that's finally going to turn the tables on the Roman oppression and put things back where they belong with God's chosen people back on top like they were in the days of King David. That's how things should be. When we're not under someone else's authority and we have our own king. And that's why so much of the messianic expectations, the expectations for this Messiah, this chosen anointed one who would be king, had to do with political authority. And that's why they were dying to crown him king. And as Jesus in his way of doing everything in such a simple, humble way, rides in on a young donkey and fulfills an Old Testament prophecy. "Do not be afraid, daughter Zion." Zion is just a nickname for Jerusalem and the Jewish nation. "Do not be afraid, daughter Zion. See, your king is coming, seated on a donkey's colt." How cute is that? I mean, that's all Jesus. He didn't need some big entourage or anything like that. But he does say, you know, everyone's making a big deal and they're all, "Jesus, look at everybody that's come to check you out." And Jesus just sort of in a nonchalant, probably just shrugged his shoulders, said out of the side of his mouth, "You know what? Nobody showed up today. The rocks themselves would cry out. Because what's about to happen is going to change everything." And so, exciting stuff. Palm Sunday kicks it off. And so, everybody wants a king. We're all fascinated with royalty. And so, any of you guys watch any of these shows? I mean, they're all over. I know we've got Games of Thrones fans in here. And I don't know if that show Royals is any good, but it sure looks funny. Tudors, it's a fascinating show that follows the whole tenure of Henry VIII and all the political stuff he gets into. But we're all caught up and fascinated with royalty. I mean, it's just this, you know, even centuries later of blowing off any monarchies, you know, and leaving that behind in old Europe. But still, it gets our attention. We love the history. Something about a king. Everybody wants that king. And Israel, the nation of Israel, wanted one. Even though they did great having God as their king for thousands of years, but then they demanded a king. God gave them human kings, and that's when everything got complicated. But still, we get caught up in this idea of royalty. And so what can a king do for us? And that's the sentiment that the show Denise and I are into these days is this BBC show, The Musketeers, you know, and it just, you can't stand that Louis the 13th. You know, if you're a Three Musketeers fan like I am, you know, he's always getting in the way. You know, the Musketeers are these cool guys, but they've always got to obey the king's will, even though it's just this crazy whim of, you know, something that he changes his mind about, somebody dies, you know, and somebody, you know, if he decides to offer mercy, then somebody, he, you know, gets mercy. He has that sovereignty because the kings were patterned after the attributes of God. Whatever the king says, that's law. And it's just funny to see how the Musketeers always got to deal with Louis's whims, and it's entertaining stuff. But back then, it was more than just entertainment. This meant we might finally get what we want and get it back to the way it's supposed to be, according to what we want. And so let's look. Let's dive into 1 Corinthians 15, and let's start to see, kind of make this comparison as we've been doing week after week in culture versus Christianity, this comparison of a crown versus a cross when it comes to Jesus' path to kingship. So now, brothers and sisters, Paul is saying, I want to remind you of the gospel I preached to you, which you received and on which you have taken your stand. The end of his letter is coming up, and he wants to get back to the roots of what is really the center of the gospel. By this gospel, you are saved if you hold firmly to the word I preached to you. Otherwise, you have believed in vain. Everything you've been talking about, everything you've heard from me, everything that has been going on, it's meaningless if this isn't at the center. For what I received, I passed on to you as of first importance, that Christ died. Now right there, those are heavy words back in that Greek culture that had to accept that this powerful God not only could come in the flesh, but let himself be impacted by mortal men in a negative way, even to death. Christ died for our sins, according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day, according to the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, a nickname for Peter, and then to the 12. After that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, which is Jesus's half-brother. Then to all the apostles, and last of all, he appeared to me also, as to one abnormally born. It's Paul's phrase that he uses to describe his timing, that he came late to the game, you know, after persecuting the church. Whether then it is I or they, this is what we preach, and this is what you believed. And I want to reach back into the first chapter of this incredible letter that Paul has penned to really get back to how significant a leap and a challenge it was in that culture to grab a hold of Jesus' kingship and the way God revealed himself to the world in a way nobody was expecting and was very difficult to grasp and hold on to. But remember back in chapter 1, and we got a glimpse of this, but I want to, as we're starting off Holy Week, really want to make sure we get all the depth out of this as possible. For the message of the cross is foolishness. Those are attention-getting words right there. The message of the cross to a worldly culture, especially that Greek culture back then, who viewed their gods as all-powerful, way above the corruption of mortal flesh, and any respectable god wouldn't have anything to do with the mortal flesh. They are above and beyond it. And so it's absolutely ridiculous foolishness, went against all the great, anything any of the great respectable philosophers had to say about the gods and their relationship with the humans. The message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it's the power of God. For it's written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, the intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. God's way of doing things are not our way of doing things. Where is the wise person? Where is the teacher of the law? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand signs and Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. We preach a God that let himself be killed at the hands of mortal men. Why do we do that? It's a stumbling block to the Jews and just foolishness to the Gentiles. But this is why. To those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. that's why we preach it. Well, there was a much different expectation for a king and a Messiah back then, and especially on this Palm Sunday here in the outskirts of Jerusalem. And that same expectation that the gospel really had to upend is a big part of Paul's challenge to get in the heads of his congregation. And this is why. At the time of Jesus, the expectation for the Jewish Messiah, the hero which the Old Testament spoke about, was for a strong military leader, similar to King David, who would come and deliver Israel from Roman bondage and set up a kingdom where Israel would rule. The people of Jerusalem clearly expressed this belief as they shouted praises to God, the mighty works that they had seen Jesus do, and called out, "Hosanna, save us," when he rode into Jerusalem on a donkey. They treated him like a conquering hero. Then when he allowed himself to be arrested, tried, and crucified on a cursed cross, most of the people, seeming even his closest disciples, stopped believing that he was the promised prophet. I want you to kind of take that in a little bit. Everyone had their huge expectations that this was finally it. And they had built a certain box for God to fit into. This is how God needs to act and be like in order for us to get what we want, to get our fair share, to get what's right. And when it didn't come through, when it really failed in the eyes of even most of Jesus' own inner circle, everyone just melted away. Jesus followed a much different path than everyone wanted for him, that anyone was expecting. And we don't sit in judgment about that. And today, I've got a very challenging message, and I've had to grapple with this all week long myself. And I want to express it with much humility, because it is so daunting. But before we get into that, I really want to make sure we all really appreciate this path that God felt was the correct path to salvation, even though it goes against any of our natural instincts or worldly or human expectations. As we look back on history, we probably would have felt the same way. We probably would have reacted the same way. Here's our celebrity. Here's our hero. Here's what we want him to do for us. And then it went south. Well, I guess I'm just going to find salvation, happiness, fairness somewhere else, because that didn't fit into my box. But let's follow Jesus down this path of the cross, and I've done my best because to kind of edit this information. I didn't want it to be too graphic. You probably weren't prepared to come here necessarily, hear a lot about what Jesus went through necessarily. But I remember years ago, and I don't know if anybody here has seen the movie The Passion of the Christ, which was one of the most graphically detailed, in a very accurate way. Much research was done on exactly how a crucifixion happened. And I remember taking our youth group to that movie. And I mean, it was rated R. I made sure everybody had slips filled out by parents. But still, in the midst of it, I question, you know, is this a good idea? Because these freshman girls that are bawling their eyes out right now, I'm feeling a little squeamish. And I just felt this peace from God that, you know, because I'm like, man, these kids are going to be scarred for life on this. And there's this kind of peace from God, well, if you're going to be scarred for life on anything, that's the thing to carry. Because we'll never forget what our King and our best friend went through to ensure our salvation for eternity.
So follow along with me, and I think we can all stomach it. Crucifixion, little history here, because I know you guys like the background on this stuff, and so I'm encouraged to continue to bring that into our messages here. It goes way back to the Persian culture and nailing criminals to trees. Alexander the Great thought, wow, that's a great idea when he kind of moved into the area and he picked up on that. It's like, hey, you know, let's borrow that one. And he improved on it and it carried into some of the Greek culture. And then when the Romans came along, they were blown away about how beautifully horrible such and the potential to really, really inflict pain that this process brought. And they perfected it. The Romans perfected crucifixion as a punishment designed to maximize pain and suffering. It wasn't about killing somebody. It was about killing somebody with the most pain possible for the longest time possible. It was the most disgraceful form of execution. It was usually reserved for slaves, foreigners, revolutionaries, the vilest of criminals. The only time a Roman citizen ever got that was desertion from the army. But that's how serious the Romans took their military, of course. Oh, and I forgot to mention, just in time for Jesus, by the way, is really when it started becoming, you know, part of the regular process in Roman culture. And so, interesting timing there. Crucifixion usually followed a thorough flogging, which was incredibly painful in itself. And I've edited out exactly the ways they would prepare the whips with the different metals and bones and things like that. Sorry. The victim would carry his own crossbar from the flogging area inside the city to the crucifixion area outside the city walls. And so, you know, in most of our artwork, because it just kind of looks better, I think, you know, we see the whole cross on the shoulder. But from all the research, it was simply the crossbar. And most of the times they were, you know, their arms were tied like, you know, so it's that kind of Rocky IV style. Blank looks. All right, thanks, Chase. But so it's over the shoulders, you know, and I mean, so you can imagine trying to carry a timber 75 to 125 pounds, you know, down winding streets, up a hill to your death after you've already had the living, you know what, beat out of you. You had to carry this thing. In fact, when me and Pete were standing there at Home Depot the other day, we were trying to think, okay, We're the ones that are going to be lugging this around. We were originally going to go the 4x4 on the crossbar, and we kind of wussed out on that. We said, you know what, let's go the 2x. And so, but Jesus had that full heavy timber, much more than that whole piece would be. It was always outside the city because the process was so horrible and disturbing to citizens. And so that's why I had to walk outside of the city walls up onto that hill. The victim was escorted by a Roman guard who was responsible for guarding the victim until his death. One of the soldiers would display a sign with the crime written on it. You remember the little story where Pilate makes sure that the words King of the Jews in three different languages are what was Jesus' crime. That's why there's that. You often see that in the artwork, that sign posted on the top of the cross. Well, that was carried alongside Jesus, so everyone could see why this guy was being punished this way. He was punished because he was King of the Jews. The victim would then be nailed to the crossbar. The crossbar would be raised and placed on the upright post where the victim's feet would be nailed to the post. Once crucified, a victim would live for a period ranging from a few hours to a few days. That all depended on how bad the whipping was. And without going into a bunch of detail, you can just trust me on this, that Jesus' whipping, because of what we see in the
in the New Testament record was on the spectrum of the really bad. And so that's why, you know, many times if it was a light scourging or flogging, a victim could remain for a few days up on that post. And it wasn't that you bled to death, because these guys were so good at making the spikes a certain way, you suffocated because of the way you were hung up there. The real torture was trying to get your chest cavity up to a place where you could get filled with air, and then you kind of get back down, and that was the work, and the stress on the body was fighting asphyxiation. And trying to keep breathing. If no one claimed the body, it would be left on the cross to be eaten by predatory animals. The family could, however, claim the body for burial. In this case, a Roman soldier would pierce the chest with a sword or spear to make sure the victim was dead. And if you recall, they went around to see, and a lot of times it's like, it's getting late, the boss has no overtime, so we just gotta finish these guys off quick. And so that's why, so what they would do is they would just break the legs of the victim so they wouldn't be able to keep breathing. That's why the Roman centurion was sent out there to break the legs of Jesus, and they saw that he was already dead. And so they didn't. And then everyone, in retrospect, thought, wait, wasn't there a prophecy about that? Something about, and not a bone of his will be broken, from an old psalm. And a lot of those old prophecies now came to light and came together as people went back and realized, all the little details that were put together. And that deserves a whole message to itself sometime. But the centurion did pierce his side. And that's when, and especially in Luke's version, when it says blood and water came out. And Luke, the physician, was so paying such attention to making sure that kind of detail was recorded. Because that's what would happen after a body had been dead even for a little while. That kind of fluid buildup in that part of the body, that's what would come out. It would be that mix of blood and water. And then Joseph of Arimathea, family friend, comes along, a wealthy man, and somehow greases the skids, and makes sure that we can take Jesus down and put him in a proper tomb and not leave him up there just for the buzzards or anything else. And so, but that's the path that Jesus followed, which, by this time, everyone's gone in. As soon as he was being, passed around between Herod and Pilate, and the Sanhedrin court, people were just like, okay, they've moved on. Everybody had moved on. This isn't the expected path. Jesus blows away our expectations of who he should be and how God brings salvation because of the way he followed the route to kingship. And here's where I want to land today. This is why this is just a tough message. Because Jesus invites us into a lifestyle where he's not satisfied with us being in a place where we're just going to be stagnant, we're not going to be challenged, we're not going to have a taste of what real life is all about. And here's the invitation. Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. But I wanted you to hear those words with a real detailed feeling of what a person back then would hear when you said, take up your cross. And so I hope when you hear those words, if you didn't before, you're very acquainted with what that would have meant, what it would have felt like. basically Jesus is saying, join me in a journey of self-sacrifice that is often going to be painful. Just we'll
talk about why that might be, but just let that resonate. Why the God who loves you so much would invite you into that kind of a journey with Him. And this line comes up in all three of the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. In Luke, and once again, Luke's my favorite. I mean, he's the one that just gets just, that's where you see all the detail. In Luke's version, it's like, hey, nobody caught this. He said daily. In Luke's version, Jesus says, take up their cross daily. Somehow that slipped through the cracks on Mark and Matthew. It's like, well, that's close enough. Luke said, no. You said daily. That's one of those funny, quirky things about comparing the Gospels and see who, you know, who emphasized what and who thought, well, you know, let's, you know, focus on this. And, you know, Luke said, hey, don't forget the daily. Take up our cross daily and follow this path that Jesus took. Because honestly, I think I grew up in a way that, well, that was Jesus' deal. You know, he made all the sacrifice, and I kind of get to enjoy, you know, just being on the coattails there and soak up all the blessing. Jesus is saying that here's where the blessing really is being on this path with me. You know, the Bible talks about how Jesus endured the cross for the joy set before him. He did it in joy. I mean, all that pain, he took up in joy because he knew what was going to come from it. He knew the love and joy and peace that was going to be created from the sacrifice he made. He wants to share the wealth. He wants us to be in on that too. So here's a couple challenges that I think Holy Week presents to us. But again, this isn't just to focus on this week. I mean, this is our lifetime challenge of following our King and our best friend through this journey He calls us on. And the first one is not to fall into the temptation and the trap that is so easy to do when we put our expectations on God. When we create the kind of God that fits into our box and try to, instead of trying to fit ourselves into His plan. But it's very humbling. It's a huge challenge to our pride, to our agenda, to what our hopes and ambitions bring to life. God has a much different, much deeper and better agenda that He wants us to experience and fit in for us. And so, that looks like fun, doesn't it? Okay. And so, can't compete with kids. Okay. So here's where I want to make sure I catch myself. Is when I start praying like, God, you got to do this. God, you got to make this happen. God, it's not fair. Now, God's going to hear those prayers. He might answer many of those for us, honestly, because of the grace and compassion He brings into our lives. But the prayers that are really going to grow me and have an impact on the world around me could very well sound much different than that. Because I think when Jesus invites us into that relationship of taking up our cross along with His, it's on a path that is not only going to help us really appreciate the salvation He's brought to us, that's the path that's going to really make a difference into the lives around us and bring His salvation in a very real way to our families, our co-workers, our neighbors, our friends, our enemies, those that we've written off, those that are just annoying, those that
we don't have time for. Those that we don't understand and really kind of want to avoid. It's not going to be easy. In fact, our first clue is if it really seems to suck and be a big pain, maybe we're on the right path. If it seems to be complicated, messy, very unrewarding, that sounds a lot like the path that Jesus took to ensure my welfare now and for eternity. And so, how do we enter into that path?
How do we deal with it every day? Each one of us has to answer that question in our own way. And so there is no right or wrong. There's no cookie cutter way to do that. Ryan, we got to get you up here playing some music here to drown those guys out. I can't do it. But they're having too much fun. I can't say anything. Oh, so cute.
But as we worship now together, as we share communion together, let it sink in and let it carry through your week, especially this week. I really hope it's just a very concentrated time this week, but that also will always stay with you. But any opportunity that has to do with denying yourself for the welfare of someone else is a very blatant clue that you're on the right path. That you are walking in the way that Jesus wants to lead you. And if you kept yourself going, it's okay. You're in the right place. It's supposed to be journey with Jesus is full of joy and blessing because of the self-sacrifice that is part of it. It's completely upside down from anything else you're going to hear in our culture. And this is why it was such a challenge for Jesus, for Paul, for anyone taking the gospel seriously to live that out in a culture, in a world, back then and today, that says the path of least resistance, that maximizes the pleasure and minimizes the pain, is what life is all about. That's the tension. That's the uphill battle. Every day of our lives, we're trying to find that easier path. Where Jesus says the path to joy, to salvation, to blessing, life with me, comes through following my path. It's the path of the cross, and I hope that every time you see a cross this week and every day of your life, you would realize what that path is about, your place on that path with Jesus, and the incredible impact that comes not only into your life, but through your life into others because you have the courage and faith to walk that path, again, with your King and with your best friend. Ryan, come on up and lead us in a time where we can draw even closer to God, Lord Jesus. Thank you that you invite us onto this path. It's incredibly scary. But knowing that you have walked it before us, and knowing because of how gentle and you are, and you can lead me by the hand and start me off on some baby steps to learn how to love like you, deny myself, and let others go ahead to give to others what otherwise I could have had for myself.
feel ready, the way we sow every week, we celebrate communion here at Neighborhood Church.
And you're invited in your timing to come to the Lord's table. Take your time, reflect, worship. And when you're ready, Jesus is always ready for you. And in His name.